Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon. Today, you guys are going to learn a lot about your feet, posture. We are interviewing someone fabulous. Mark Sisson has been shaking up the world of health and fitness for over 20 years. He has ignited the ancestral health movement starting back in 2006. He had a wildly successful blog, his Daily Apple, his best-selling book, The Primal Blueprint. And he really has popularized the ketogenic diet and given millions of healthy grocery shoppers access to healthy things with his Primal Kitchen food company. Now, Mark is changing the way the world walks with his latest venture. This is a shoe company called Paluva and his latest book, Born to Walk. So, welcome to the podcast, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Dr. K.
This is fabulous. And I first heard about you. Actually, one of my patients was wearing your fabulous shoes with the five toes. And I was like, so like, wow, what are you wearing? Why are you wearing it? And she happened to be 75 years old, and she's just like this fit, spry, healthy longevity chick. And so I immediately got a pair and I've been loving them. And tell me all about this special shoe that you've designed.
Well, it's a long story. This goes back 35 or 40 years. I was a runner, a pretty good runner in the late 70s, early 80s. And in those days, when you ran in the late 60s and early 70s, you ran in minimalist shoes, very thin, flat shoes, Chuck Taylors. There were no thick cushioned running shoes. So all of us who became runners got used to minimalist footwear. And we didn't get injured. I mean, we knew when it was time to stop running because, your feet would feel from the thinness of the shoe, 50 miles or 60 miles was enough to run for the entire week. Well, in the 70s, this guy, Phil Knight, comes along and a coach, Bill Bowerman, they say, we have some of the best runners in the world with the Oregon track team and with the U.S. In general, with marathoners, let's make some thick shoes, some padded cushion shoes, so that these poor guys can run, 100 miles a week and 120 miles a week and start to compete on the world scene. So they made these shoes and they were amazing. It did allow runners like me to go from 40 or 50 miles a week to running 120 miles a week, but I still got injured. I got different kinds of injuries. I got injuries in my knees and my hips. And it wasn't until years later that I realized that all the cushioning was doing was sort of bypassing the important information that the bottoms of my feet needed in order to perfectly orchestrate my kinetic chain from the bottoms of my feet up through my ankles, up through my calves, my knees, my shins, my knees, my hips. So I had to retire from competing because of these injuries. And I took 25 years, I started looking into all other aspects of health and fitness and how could I be long, strong, and lean and fit and happy with the least amount of pain and suffering and 100-mile weeks. So that sort of informed all of the stuff I did with Primal Blueprint, with my book, with Mark's Daily Apple, the blog, even with Primal Kitchen. Like, how can we transform food in a way that makes healthy eating more palatable? How can I, the things that I put on food, how can I make them the food more tasty and give it more variety? So when I sold Primal Kitchen a couple of years ago, I was able to turn my attention back to this thing that had plagued me my entire life. I hate shoes. I don't like wearing shoes. I like going barefoot. I love the fact that my feet want to be barefoot. My toes want to splay outwardly. I've always had problems with fashion footwear, the narrow Italian pointy shoes or the boots or the raised heels or any of that stuff. So I've always hated shoes. So this newfound freedom when I sold Primal Kitchen and some resources allowed me to really turn my attention to, okay, how can I make a shoe that lets feet do what feet want to do? Feet want to be able to feel the ground, so the shoe has to be thin. It has to be able to what we call ground feel. You want to feel everything you step on. Whether it's pebbles or rocks or holes in the ground or sticks, the foot wants to feel that so it can adjust and accommodate the pressure. Your toes want to splay outward. Like most shoes cramp your big toe against the other toes. Whereas the big toe, which is the most important toe in the foot and is sort of the main focal point of your locomotion, that's the last thing you push off when you leave the ground, either walking or running or jumping or whatever else. When you scrunch that big toe against the other ones, it atrophies. And in many cases, women in particular who are wearing like really fashionable high heels, you get a malformed shoe, you get dysfunction, you get bunions, you get plantar fasciitis, you get shortened calf muscles that then put strain on the Achilles tendon. So I wanted to develop a shoe that was optimal for foot health, foot comfort, and that was the genesis of Paluva. So we've developed this five-toed shoe that allows your feet to feel the ground, allows your toes to articulate, move independently according to whatever the surface of the ground is. It allows your ankle to do what your ankle's supposed to roll, Dr. K. It's supposed to roll. It's not supposed to
Oh
be
my
stiff.
God, are you serious? Because yeah,
Yes.
actually, yesterday my manager just fractured her tibia and fibula. Her ankle rolled, but I mean, it
Yeah,
was
but you know why? It rolled because it was
not.
not. If she's wearing regular shoes and you roll an ankle, you roll an ankle that's been atrophied from years of disuse because you've been encasing it in a stiff shoe or a stiff boot, or you haven't done the work, or you've cramped all the toes together in fashionable footwear, and all the toes, every one of the intrinsic muscles of the feet has atrophied. Yeah, the ankle, when you roll the ankle, there's no strength, there's no support, there's no resilience. Versus if you train the foot, if you train the ankle, if you wear the types of shoes that are continuously passively training your feet to become stronger, then you step on a, gopher hole or something and you roll your ankle and yeah, whatever, so roll the ankle is resilient. And none of this bad stuff tends to happen if you're strong and resilient.
Yeah, when, I guess so. When you separate the toes, they have more of a gripping function, so they develop
The toes,
the intrinsic
exactly, the toes,
muscles.
your fingers, look, you're a surgeon. You need your fingers to articulate, to move independently, to grip, to do all the things they do. Your toes are no different. Your toes are just like your fingers. They want to move independently. You need to have gloves for your feet, not oven mitts for your feet,
Yeah,
right? Yeah. It's
literally. How
yeah,
does
so
it
that's
impact your back and your postural muscles?
You
'Cause
know, one of the greatest compliments we get, testimonials we get on a regular basis, very early on, is, within sometimes moments, but sometimes days of wearing this, oh, my lower back pain seems to be resolving, or the issues that I had with the strain in my glutes or whatever, because it does enhance your normal natural posture. Your posture depends on you being flat-footed, not having a heel raised. We weren't born with our heels raised off the ground, and yet every shoe that we wear, every cushioned running, whether it's hiking boots or cushioned running shoes or high heels or pumps, they all raise the heel off the ground. And that, among many other things, that shortens the calf muscle. So the calf now gets used to becoming short. And then when you go barefoot, if you take those shoes off after a long day, now it doesn't feel so good because your foot has become used to being in this position where the heel is elevated. So we want people to walk around with what we call zero drop in their shoe. That the there should be no height in the heel of a shoe that you're wearing. There should be no drop from the point of the heel to the midfoot or the toes. We want it to be flat. We want it to be flexible. So you want to be able to feel the ground underneath. You want to be wide. And again, with these individual toe boxes, it accommodates everyone's foot. Your feet want to be splayed outwardly. They don't want to be scrunched together. So you know how many people wear toe spacers and toe spreaders now? Like you know
Yeah.
that's a thing, right? Lots of women in particular, they get home and they put on the toe spacers and they hang out on the sofa for an hour or two with their toe spreaders on. Well, it would be so much better if you walked with those and you were able to start to use the muscles in the toes while the toes were spread out. Kind of impractical if you're trying to put those into a regular shoe. So we just created a shoe that has natural toe spreaders, natural toe spacing that allows the toes to move independently and articulate independently and allows people to regain that lost strength. Allows those intrinsic muscles to continue to get stronger and stronger and more resilient and get more realigned over time.
You think that helps people as they age to not fall as much and to
You
have
know,
much more stability?
100%. So more and more research suggests that one of the markers for one of the highest risk factors for mortality in people over 65 is falling. And one of the markers for that is foot strength, right? And one of the markers for that is big toe strength. So my friend Courtney Conley, who's a chiropractor in Southern California and one of the most knowledgeable people on foot health I've ever met, she will say that it's as good a metric for mortality, risk of mortality, as grip strength, and that is your big toe strength. So she has an entire program that teaches people how to regain foot strength, exercises they can do, stretches they can do to regain the strength and mobility in their feet. What we do is we offer a shoe that sort of passively allows you to do that all day long while you're wearing them. Every step you take, you're using those small muscles in your feet. You're using those intrinsic muscles. You're realigning the toes, and the effect on balance, for instance, is incredible. We have a lot of women over 60 who wear my shoes in the gym to train with their trainers. And one of the first things a trainer will say when they're doing lunges or any single leg work is, "Oh my God, your balance is so much better just because your toes are now able to form that base." And then the feedback to the brain when you're using the different parts of the toes to actually reestablish a center point in terms of balance is so it's so markedly better than just wearing thick, like Hokas or Nikes or whatever people are wearing these days that kind of wobble. It's almost like standing on a Bosu ball all the time. It's not good for the knees. Certainly doesn't train the intrinsic muscles of the feet the way our shoes do. So we're really excited about people being able to regain this sort of foot health and foot strength, which includes better balance, better proprioception. Proprioception is sort of the awareness that we have of where we are in space. So, if you look at anybody of any age, kids, teenagers, people in their 20, they trip once in a while. You trip over something, but they don't fall and break a hip and die. They trip. And they, because they're strong and because they have this sense of proprioception, they're strong enough to put another foot out in front and catch themselves from falling. Or to be able to, or to maybe to spring, if maybe it's a big trip that you take and you got to take three steps and it's a sprint steps, but you don't necessarily fall. People trip all the time. So it's not like only old people trip and then that's this cascade of problems. Everybody trips. But if you're strong enough, if you have the balance and the strength in your feet to recover, nothing bad happens. Well, as we get older, we develop this atrophy. We develop this lack of strength and resilience in the feet. We lose the dynamic ability to recover from a simple trip on a pair of sweatpants you tried to take off, or the cat in the middle of the night, or the kids' Legos and whatever it is,
Exactly. I
and
think
yes.
the feet are, there's so much cultural weight too in shoes and feet from, Asian cultures binding the feet and women having tight, restricted feet and high heels, which after COVID, I think so many women stopped wearing high heels and realized that their foot health and happiness was so much better. And now those,
Yes.
the marshmallow, big old Hokas that people are, there's so many trends and things in footwear. How are we going to make like proprioception and having five open toes sexy?
Yeah, well, I mean that's the thing. And yet you commented when we were offline about our friend Chalene Johnson, who is the most girly girl that I
She
know.
is,
And she wears Puluvas when she's out doing her
she's
stuff and she's at
fabulous.
the gym.
I have to show the audience that I'm wearing my pajamas right here. I've got my white coat on. These are great because I stand the whole entire day. I'm seeing like 20, 25 patients in a day, and I'm on my feet. But like honestly, my back does not feel tired by the end of the day.
And you're on concrete, right? When you're in a medical setting, it's usually linoleum or concrete or a really hard surface. We have a lot of nurses who, as you know, are on their feet all the time, who swear by Puluvas. This is an example for those who couldn't see. This is what the shoe, it's a good-looking shoe. This is one I wear. It's got five toes, but it looks like a regular shoe, but
Yeah,
it's
runner.
flexible enough that it does all the things I say, and you can articulate the toes. And then we make like there's a leather. This is a leather lace-up for the workplace. This is one that I
That's
wear
cute.
for. Yeah, thanks. And this is, by the way, this is the one that Dr. Rob, the surgeon I was telling you about, does. He operates in these, and it's kind of interesting because it looks like it's a thick shoe. It's not.
Yeah.
It's It's still, this was made to look like a regular shoe, but it's still only 1 centimeter of what we call stack height. So it's still low to the ground.
That's neat. I've seen another new trend with tennis shoes that have a high heel built into them so people can feel taller, like platforms and stuff like that.
Yeah,
And
well,
that's like the opposite direction
it's
of
the
what
opposite of
we're
what we're
trying.
doing. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. How do you think foot function's connected to longevity and aging gracefully? Like we talked about,
Yeah.
falling.
The most egregious example I just gave, which is that of you lose your foot strength and you trip and you break a hip and then, you die. The
Yeah.
statistics on people who break their hip and then wind up being either dead with it, 25% of them are dead within a year, and another 25% are immobile for the rest of their lives. It's not a pretty picture for old people doing that. Now that's on the far end of like, okay, let's never get there. But how does it affect longevity in general? Well, first of all, my definition of longevity has to include a quality of life, right? I want quality longevity. I'm not looking to be, like Dave Asprey and live to 180 or whatever it is and be whatever, immobile but observant of the world around me. No, I want to be mobile. Mobility is one of my key defining components of quality of life. I want to be able to travel the world and visit people and go on walks and hikes and go and walk to the gym and be able to do all my exercises. So that mobility is a key component of a quality of life. The other part, by the way, is access to cognition. So I want to be able to have access to my memories and have conversations with people. Those are the two defining elements of quality of life for me in terms of longevity. But in order to maintain all of your working parts, if you want your liver to function, if you want your heart to function, your lungs to function, your kidneys, that all depends on you using your muscles. So many of the longevity experts will say muscle, maintaining muscle mass as you get older is more important even than cardiovascular health. Why is that? Well, muscles are what drive metabolism. Muscles are what By using your muscles, you're requiring your heart to pump faster. By using your muscles, you're requiring your lungs to inspire greater. By using your muscles, you're requiring your liver to process more toxins, to access and process more fuel. So all of the organs depend on you exercising, depend on you using your muscles and exercising. And you need your feet to be able to do most of the exercises we do in the gym. Yeah, if you're in a wheelchair, you can do some upper body stuff, but without foot strength, without good foot health, without planting your feet firmly on the ground, you can't do deadlifts, you can't do squats, you can't do lunges, you can't jump up and down, you can't do box jumps, you can't. All of the lower body exercises that are so critical to, again, achieving and maintaining good muscle mass and good posture require strong feet. It blows my mind that every athlete knows this, but they don't pay as much attention to it as they should. Everything you do in life depends on your contact with the ground. Every step you take, every running step you take, every jump, every time you plant your feet to hit a tennis ball or a pickleball or to whatever you're to dance. I mean, everything you do starts with your contact, your connection with the earth, and that is through your feet. And so it makes it critically important that what you put on your feet to enhance that connection, you'd think that people would be, very aware that, oh my gosh, like the more I'm able to strengthen my feet, the longer I'm going to live because I'll be able to walk, I'll be able to go to the gym, I'll be able to do all the exercises, I'll do all the things that define longevity.
Yeah, I think that the older we get, the more we understand the comfort and function and like functionality, but basically is way more important than fashion. Like the more I want to live in like really comfortable athletic leisure wear and shoes that make me propel forward. You've said in some of your writing that we were born to walk. What does that mean, sort of in the context of the modern movement, habits?
Well, so I wrote the book almost tongue in cheek as a response to a best-selling book that came out a bunch of years ago called Born to Run. And the thesis of that book was we were born to run. We were, ancestrally, our ancestors chased down big animals and hunted them, and it was our prowess as animals on 2 feet who could run long distances without overheating, who could sniff and track and use our brains to decipher what path an animal was going to take. And so over a period of 2 hours, we could chase down a large beast and tire it out and jab a stick in it. Well, yeah, so we were born to be able to run. But the reality is we were born to walk. We were born to walk everywhere. We populated this planet walking everywhere. The fact that we can run doesn't mean we should run a lot. It doesn't mean we should jog, 8 minute miles or 9 minute miles 5 or 6 times a week in pursuit of some health goal. So the entire book, Born to Walk, kind of takes down the running boom of the last 50 years as having been wholly inappropriate for all but 2% of the population. That 2% who are skinny, ectomorphs with large lung capacity, with high pain tolerance, with nothing else to do, who are not genetically gifted to play any other sports. Yeah, those people can go run and can go participate. But for a mesomorph or an endomorph, a large person, to think that running is a way to achieve better health and longevity, it's a bad mistake to go down that path. And so many people have tried over the years. Running is a horrible way to lose weight. Diet is the best, as you know, diet and a particular type of diet that allows for metabolic flexibility, allows you to burn off your own stored body fat, is the best way to lose weight. And then, yeah, you want to walk a lot. I'm a big fan of walking. And by the way, I'm a big fan of sprinting. So let's not conflate sprinting and running. Running, in my world, because I did it for so long, running long distances is catabolic. It tears the body down. Sprinting is anabolic if you do it right. Sprinting once a week, well trained, you have to lift the weights and you have to get ready to be able to sprint. And it doesn't have to be running sprinting. It could be cycling. It could be, swimming sprinting. It could be anything that's a max effort for 20 or 30 seconds times, 6 or 8 of those repetitions once a week. So we're born to walk. We're born to sprint. We're born to lift heavy things, go to the gym, lift weights, build that muscle mass. But we're not born to run metronomically an hour a day. It doesn't serve anyone except the running shoe manufacturers who are making thicker and thicker shoes because more and more people still tend to get injured, and then they think that a thicker shoe is gonna save them, gonna change them, and it's exact opposite. It's gonna make it worse.
That's true. I think that running is very destructive. I heard a quote the other day that exercise is not good for you. It actually is very destructive and catabolic, but it's the rebuilding of after exercise effects where you get the longevity benefits as your body.
100%, 100%. The exercise itself is a destructive hormetic experience, right? Hormesis means we're doing something that's stressful in the short term, knowing that the body has the resources to build back even stronger from it in the long term. And so that's why, for instance, sprinting is good. You do it once a week and you allow plenty of time to recover and repair, and you do get stronger and healthier. Now, by the same token, lifting weights. I tell people, don't lift weights more than twice a week. I'm 72 years old. I can't recover in 3 days from a good weightlifting workout. I want to break it down, but I only want to break it down if I allow enough time and nutrients to repair and become stronger for having gone to the gym. Where people go wrong and they go off the rails is they think, well, if lifting weights twice a week is good, I bet lifting weights 6 times a week is even better. Or if running is good for me once a week, then I bet if I run every single day, I'll get stronger and I'll get leaner and I'll get fitter. And that's the point that you made, is that if you run every single day, running is catabolic, and you never give yourself a chance to recover, to repair from the damage you've done if you are a chronic runner, if you're somebody out there, which is why lifetime runners, most of them, if they didn't start as a weight loss strategy, they started because they were good runners, and they just feel like they have to run. They're all skinny. They've all lost muscle mass because it's so catabolic if you're running 50 or 60 or 80 miles a week.
Any thoughts on bioregenerative kind of biohacking with peptides and shots that help you to rebuild muscle?
Yeah, I mean, I've tried a bunch of the peptides. They haven't really worked for me. I have been doing TRT. I've been doing HRT, testosterone replacement, for 10 years now. That's pretty much the only thing I do. And it's I didn't need to do it, but it was something I chose to do because of the level of high level training that I do. So when I tell people, that training, is catabolic and tears you down, don't get me wrong, I train, but I'm very cognizant of what the recovery times should be to recover from a hard workout, or what constitutes an easy workout. Like today, my wife and my friend and I, we hike, we're in France, we hiked for 1 hour and 40 minutes, right? And it's not catabolic, it's a long hike, and it really had a great effect. That's not going to tear me down. But if I'd run 45 minutes to cover that same ground, I'd need 2 days to recover from that, just because of the damage that I would have done to myself. So there's a level at which again, once again, born to walk. Almost no amount of walking is too much for a well-trained person.
Well, I was going to ask you that next. Like, what is too much for your feet? Like, we do stand all day, and like sometimes you get home and your dogs are barking, your feet are really aching.
Yeah, but
What is too much?
if your feet are strong and if you're well trained, then your body will tell you when that's too much, and it won't be because you've injured yourself. It'll just be, yeah, I'm a little sore, a little tired. I think I'll take some weight off. Our ancestors didn't sit on a sofa. They sat cross-legged or whatever. They found what we call archetypal rest positions to rest in. They didn't stand on their feet all day. They were, even though they didn't have chairs and sofas and things like that to sit on, they certainly did not stand all day. They were able to find these archetypal rest positions. But I think I know before I had my shoes, before I had Pulluvas, if I went for that same walk today, my knees would be hurting because I would not have had the organization of the kinetic chain to know exactly which way to bend the knee or roll the ankle or do all the things that the kinetic chain wants us to do. But without the information coming directly from the bottoms of the feet, like every time you take a step, that by the time you weight that forward foot in a thin shoe or barefoot, the brain has all the information it needs on exactly how much to bend or articulate each toe to accommodate the surface, how much to roll the ankle out a little bit, because the ankle's supposed to roll. Remember, we said that. How much to dip the knee to accommodate the change in height from stepping down off of a rock or something like that. All of these things are clear to the brain, and the brain can then organize your kinetic chain if you have this ground feel, if you have the ability to feel the ground. If you're wearing a thick boot, a hiking boot, or a running shoe that has thick cushioning, none of that information reaches the brain, and the brain has to guess. So I guess I roll the ankle this much. I guess I bend the knee this much. But that's where people get problems. They get knee pains, or they get shin pains, or they get lower back pains, or their glute starts to hurt, or they get inner thigh issues, or they get they get knock-kneed or duck-footed or whatever, because the shoes are forcing their feet into a position that is not serving the kinetic chain in a way that people were designed. And I have people come to me all the time and they go, "But Mark, I was born with flat feet. I was born, I'm knock-kneed, I'm pigeon-toed, I'm what?" No, you were born with perfect feet. Whether they're flat or have a pronounced arch, they've got musculature that works if you use it. So it doesn't, a great arch doesn't require that it look like an arch. It's just got to be a strong muscle, and it could look flat. People are
Interesting. So
born.
when like you said, when you're on a hike and you're wearing very thick shoes, your toes can't adjust. So actually,
Yes.
knees and much stiffer joints that are not designed to move end up getting the ache because they're doing the
Yeah,
injury.
or sometimes they get tweaked because you step sideways on a rock, and because you don't have the ground feel, the brain can't accommodate it. Now what should have been a little bit of a roll from the ankle to offset that torque now becomes an entire tweak of the knee, because you put your foot in a cast, in a stiff hiking boot that won't let the ankle roll, and that has no information on exactly what's going on underneath the foot. All it knows is you just stepped sideways on a rock and you slipped off of it, and now your knee is tweaked. And that should never happen. If our ancestors were, they walked, they hiked everywhere, every day. If they tweaked a knee that way and they got injured, they were dead.
That's it.
They were,
Evolution will get them.
yes.
How did you come up with the ancestral health and primal kitchen ideas about eating in a more ketogenic diet way?
I've always been interested in health, and as an athlete, I was looking for ways to enhance my performance, and that meant ways to train without getting injured, and it meant ways to fuel myself through food. So I was an early experimenter with high dose mega, multivitamins. I was early on the carbo loading bandwagon until I realized that was exactly the wrong way to be training. So I've always experimented with a lot of these different ways of eating. And I guess that I had an aha moment when I was 45. I mean, I was well into my 40s, writing about health and fitness, always mostly about training, but a lot about diet. And I realized, I had irritable bowel syndrome most of my life, from the age of 14 till about 45, and it ran my life. It was horrible. And then I had arthritis as a result of the running, but also had arthritis in my hips and my ankles and my hands. I had bad skin. I had GERD. I had hemorrhoids. I mean TMI. But I had all this stuff that was gut related. And at some point, I've been writing about grains for a long time, and then my and whether or not they were healthy. And my wife said, "Look, you're writing about grains. Why don't you just not eat grains for a month and see what happens?" Well, in that month of giving up grains, and by the way, I assumed grains were like, "Oh my God, everybody has to eat grains. They're like the staff of life." In that month of giving up grains, my irritable bowel syndrome went away forever. My GERD went away. My arthritis went away. My sinus infections that I got 6 or 8 times a year went away. Never got hemorrhoids again ever. All of these things that had plagued me were all related to my diet, and that's what got me started on this exploration about, okay, what is it about the human diet? What are the things in the human diet that we should not be eating, but we assume are okay to eat? And so grains, my cutting out grains was the first piece of a puzzle that I had been working on for a long time, which was basically before 10,000 years ago. Our ancestors ate fruits, plants, they ate plants and animals, they ate fruits and vegetables, some maybe starchy tubers in the ground. And then, meat, fish, fowl, eggs, nuts, seeds, vegetables, and a little bit of fruit, but they did not eat grains. They did not eat processed foods. They did not eat high fructose corn syrup. They did not eat industrial seed oils. And so by giving up all of those things and having my health, which was already pretty good, externally I looked fit. By giving all those up and realizing, holy crap, my life is so much better eating the way our ancestors ate. Our ancestors did not have access to any processed foods, to any industrial seed oils. So by cutting out pies, cakes, candies, cookies, sugar, sweetened beverages, by cutting out, pasta and cereal, and coming down to this list of meat, fish, fowl, eggs, nuts, seeds, vegetables, my life changed. Now, cut to 10 years later of writing about this, I realize, oh my God, it's a pretty short list of things that people can eat. So what makes this whole way of eating palatable and sustainable are the methods of preparation, the things you put on the food, the spices, the herbs, the sauces and dressings and toppings, the way you cook them. And that's what got me started with Primal Kitchen. That's where I said, okay, I'm going to make the kind of things that you can put on food that are derived from healthy ingredients that are natural, so that the more you put on your steak or your chicken or your vegetables or your salad, the better it is for you and the better it tastes. And that will then encourage people to eat healthy all the time.
Interesting. I think I read that you said that collagen should be its own macronutrient and
Yes.
it should be like the fourth major nutrient behind protein and fat.
Yes. Yeah.
Carbs. We'll talk
Yeah.
about that.
Yeah, because it is a macronutrient. I mean, we need grams and grams of collagen peptides every day. And historically, again, if you look back, all our ancestors ate nose to tail. They ate the tendons, and they ate the knuckles, and they ate the nether parts of the animal, and they boiled the remaining parts of the carcass down and made broth or made stock. right up until our grandparents did in the, 50s and 60s. Something happened then, and I don't know what it was, but people just, I guess it was a convenience of Campbell's soup, soup was around, and now you didn't have to make a stock. The butcher shop started or offering j the choice cuts of meat, and nobody wanted to buy the offal, the other parts of the animal. We had Knox gelatins, or I know your grandmother probably used Knox gelatin for her skin, hair, and nails. Kids ate Jell-O. That was a source of collagen peptides. So even up until the 90s, there was some source of collagen peptides in our diet. But after the 90s, when Jell-O got a bad rap for being, sugar full of sugar, and more people st stopped eating nose to tail, they just ate the choice cuts of meat. But remember skinless, boneless chicken breast, which was the big deal? Okay, so now that people now then they stopped eating chicken skin, which was a source of collagen, and they stopped eating fish skin. And so
True.
we come into the 90s, and now all of a sudden, this major source of nutrition, these collagen sources like bone broth, stock, chicken stock, chicken skin, and all the other and even gelatinized desserts were all gone. So I started noticing more injuries in the sports community because people were not giving themselves the raw materials. Look, your body has more collagen protein in it than it does muscle protein. Like, let that sink in for a little bit. There is more collagen protein between fascia, ligaments, tendons, cartilage,
Skin.
skin, hair, than there is muscle protein in the
Muscle.
body. So it and people would say, well, Mark, you can't hope to make collagen for your body from collagen you take in. We absolutely can. I mean, it's like, if you want to get more CoQ10 in your diet for your heart, you would eat heart. I mean, been an issue with like choosing people saying I want to eat like meat for, but you eat muscle meat to build muscle. You eat liver to support with vitamin A and to get liver stuff. I mean, there's a method to eating like for like. And in the world of collagen protein, if you can't get collagen from bone broth or chicken stock or chicken skin or salmon skin or chewing on the gristly parts of steak, then take a supplement. And that's really was a aha moment I had when I encountered some Achilles tendon issues about 15 years ago, and they would not resolve until I started really mega dosing with collagen peptides. And then all of a sudden, these collagen, I had Achilles tendinosis, which is a thickening of Achilles tendons. I thought I was going to have surgery. It went away within 4 months of just heavy supplementation with that. So that's that, again, another light bulb in my head went on, like, okay, we really have to give the body what
The
it needs. The
building
body
blocks.
really smart in figuring out how to fix things. But in the case of Achilles of tendon issues, if you don't give the body the raw materials it needs to rebuild that tendinous fibrous material, it goes to plan B, which is to lay down scar tissue. It says, all right, we don't have the raw materials. We can't use carbon fiber, but we can use 2x4s for a little bit here, so yeah.
That's so true. I also don't understand why people are obsessed and talk about collagen peptides not being bioavailable. Like 100% they get absorbed through small intestine if you have the right quantity. Like it
Yes.
obviously has to be more than gets digested and spills
Right. It's you're
into
right. It's
the
di and tripeptides remain intact. The gut doesn't necessarily break them down into single unit amino acids and then, cross your fingers, they get reassembled on the other side. No, the body, you're right. The gut is able to absorb some of these important di and tripeptides that are a critical part of collagen resynthesis.
Exactly. Well, I want to ask you in wrapping up some quick rapid fire questions. So,
Okay.
all right. What do you say to yourself before walking into a big room or event where you're giving a lecture?
Oh my God. I mean, I just say, let's do this. I get excited about seeing people and looking at all the faces, so I get energized by that. I'm all about let's do this.
Yeah. If you could go back to any age, what age would that be?
Pick one out of the air. 27.
Okay. Why 27?
I just that was a point at which I think my life really started to take off. And I would, if like there's a lot of things I wouldn't do over again. I wouldn't redo, because even though they were failures, I learned so much from them. Like, I wouldn't change anything about my life. But you forced me with this question to pick an age, Dr. K.
Yes, that's
So
right. I mean,
27.
mine goes to intuitively where it was like riding high and riding the waves, you know?
Yeah, so 27 is the last year of my competitive career. And it's
Wow.
just that didn't even come up in my brain when you said that. It automatically, like when you said pick one out of the thin air, I said 27, and now I'm realizing that's the year I retired due to injury. So maybe that's the universe telling me go back and maybe do it differently.
Well, there was a turning point there. What have you gained and what have you lost as you've aged?
I've gained an appreciation for family and for grandchildren and for the circle of life. I've talked a lot about I'm an evolutionary biologist at heart, and so when I talk about the sort of the irony of life as a human is that we're still only here to pass the genes on to the next generation, and everything else around us are trappings and our adaptations of how we orchestrate survival in order to be able to pass the genes along. But what you realize when you become a grandparent is that's the end result. It's seeing your own children have their children that really completes the cycle. So that's what I've gained.
Fascinating. And are you actually, you studied evolutionary biology? That's fascinating.
Oh, that's my yeah, that was my major in college.
Love that. Love that. How's your character changed over time?
How has my character changed? Or has it? I didn't.
How has it? How
Okay,
has
how
it?
has it? I like to think that I'm more patient. I'm a type A through and through, and I would say I'm more patient. In starting this shoe company, it's a huge undertaking, and it's a massive amount of money to get this off the ground. And I, when I in the old days when I had to go use like my retirement money or my family's money to start a business, I was impatient with a lack of adaptation or adoption of products. Primal Kitchen took a little while to take off, but when it took off big. With Paluva, I see in the testimonials and I see how people like yourself are responding. And particularly, you said it took you a while to get used to it, right? It took you 15 days or whatever to get used to that, and now you're used to it, and now it's like, oh my God, like why did I wait so long? So it's the patience that I have now. Like I'm just, and my son, who's my CEO, he's like, Dad, we got to do this. I'm like, all right, like, just be patient. This is gonna happen. This is gonna happen, and I'm not gonna lose one bit of sleep over this because, first of all, I have the means, but second of all, I have the patience to and the knowing that this is gonna take off.
Yeah, you're going to nurture it the right way. Let it grow slowly. If there was one thing you could ban in the footwear industry, what would that be?
If there, that's a great question. I'm gonna piss I don't want to piss off all my I just bought a house in Nashville too, in Franklin, Tennessee, and I don't want to piss off my cowboy boot wearing people. But and I don't want to piss off all the women,
The
because
high heels. There's
the
the high
Jimmy
heels.
Choos, they look good, and I don't want you to stop wearing them. I just want you to I would just say it's the thick running shoes. First of all, here's what I'd ban. I'd ban those freaking blade running shoes that they're setting all the records in now, because I think they're cheating. I think it's a real disservice to human performance to be doing this in those types of shoes. So I'd ban thick, carbon fiber running shoes.
Interesting. And the most underrated foot exercise that we should all be doing?
Walking upstairs barefoot.
Oh, okay, that's easy. I'm gonna do more of that. And finish this one sentence for me. Healthy feet are the foundation of.
Oh, healthy feet are the foundation of the rest of your life.
Yeah, that is a good quote for you right there. What's your favorite place to walk barefoot?
So I would say golf courses are my favorite places to walk barefoot.
Will they
And
even allow you to on a
no,
golf
well,
course?
no, because if I sneak on after hours,
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I've always either had a relative or myself lived near a golf course, and to be able to go on and do sprints
Yeah.
barefoot on the fairways, you know, after the course is closed or something like that, is, you know, still one of my favorite places to go barefoot.
Oh, nice. That's a wonderful image to sort of wrap up and end on. Is there one fabulous book we should be reading this summer to get us in the right headspace?
Well, I mean,
I want to, you can
Born to
say
Walk,
Born to
Born to
Walk.
Walk is the book to read. Yeah, and it will get you in the right headspace to understand that walking is appropriate for everybody. Whether you are a top runner, you need to walk, or whether you're someone who's overweight and thought, well, walking is kind of useless. Why should I do that? If I can't run, then I won't do anything because walking is not valuable. No, walking is the single best thing any human being can do. So do it.
I love that. Well, I can't thank you enough for joining us all the way from your vacation spot in France. And you really have inspired me to think more about the importance of feet and posture and stability, all these things that you kind of take for granted till you lose it. And I am definitely trying this idea of wearing, I w wear Venus compression stockings as a surgeon. I wear those, but I'm going to cut the toes off and use them with my palumbas.
There you go. Love it. I want to hear back for, feedback on that too, offline, okay?
Oh my gosh, we sure will. Where can everybody
Okay.
find you on your social handles so they can reach out?
Okay, so I am right now at Mark Sisson Primal on Instagram, Mark Sisson Primal. And then, you know, the Instagram handle for the shoes is Wear Pelluva, WearPelluva. And then we sell online at Pelluva.com. And hopefully you'll have those in show notes or links or something like that.
Yeah, we'll put those in the show notes, you guys. That's it for now. Thanks so much for tuning in and learning more about your proprioception, your posture, the importance of splaying your toes and like feeling the earth as we walk. I think this is so important as a longevity conversation. I'm going to teach our patients more about it. You guys, you can find me on my Instagram. It's Beauty by Dr. K, doing amazing things with people's faces, but also overall health and longevity. And our website is the same as beautybydrk.com. Mark, I'm going to send you some amazing skincare. And I have collagen peptides that are so great for hair, skin, and nails. I'll send you some of those too.
Awesome.
But
Awesome.
that's
I
it
will use
for
them.
now.
I
Yeah.
will use them. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Cool. All right.
You will use them. You will try them and you'll love them.
Yes, I will. Yes, I will.
Well, I can't wait to meet you in person when you're back in LA. And thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
That's it for now, guys. Stay beautiful.